things could be better. The light in here, for one thing. Seems like this depressing old room absorbs it. And these ancient painted portraits on the walls. It's funny how the faces and eyes loom out of the shadows like that. Like, every time you look, you've caught them sneaking closer and closer to you. Never mind how cold it is. These high ceilings must rob the room of heat. Worst of all is what's going on downstairs. An argument, a real battle. Who could be fighting like that in a quiet old place like this? It gets so bad, maybe you ought to go down and see what's going on. But then it stops. It stops with a gurgling scream. And the sound of blows so hard you feel them through the floorboards. In the silence that follows, you fumble out your phone to call for help. But you know it'll take time to arrive way out in the country like this. And now you hear footsteps on the stairs. Coming up. Heavy footsteps coming closer. And you wish you could bury yourself in these old books you've been reading. Bury yourself as deep as a legend. Welcome to Buried Legends. Oh, hello again. Welcome back. Welcome back to another evening in this cozy book-lined den that we call our archive. And welcome back to our story. This is part two of the tale we're calling Fool's Gold. If you haven't heard it already, I'd recommend going back and listening to the first part, where we talk about the shipwrecked sailor who was found wandering on a Washington State beach in 1911, out of his mind with exposure and shock, but with ancient gold doubloons clutched in his hands. Pieces of Drake's gold, folks said. The legendary haunted treasure that Sir Francis Drake is supposed to have buried along this coast after his raids on the Spanish in 1579. But the poor sailor found in 1911 never could, or would, tell others where he'd found the coins. So Drake's gold remained just a legend. Until a man I met found this. Sorry, my hand's shaking a little bit. Oh, the thing is as harmless as it looks, I assure you. It's just the memory of the story surrounding it that makes my grip a little unsteady. And you know, when the man who found it figured out what it was, his hand started shaking too. Because what you're holding right now has been lost for so long, it wasn't supposed to exist. It's the little missing piece of a great big story. Doesn't look like all that, does it? It looks like a limp stack of thin, squarish brown pancakes, or bits of tired old cloth browned with age. But it's paper, actually. More than 400 years old. Thick, rough old stuff, smaller than our modern sheets, each page irregularly shaped and worn limp all around the edges. Not bound together anymore. Oh, you can see some empty holes along one side to show where someone tied it loosely with string centuries ago. And every inch of every page covered with faded ink scrawl, with little sketches here and there. There are some pages missing in the middle, although that isn't obvious. But after I heard the story of this ragged bundle, I would never have touched it if those pages were still in there. Well, these papers were found, and our story begins, on the other side of the world. In a dim, dark-paneled room in an old country manor house turned museum and archive, outside the city of Leiden, in the Netherlands. The man who told me this story was sitting in that room one cloudy afternoon, going patiently over volume after volume of forgotten old documents. It was a sort of hobby of his, this rummaging around in the minutiae of the distant past. Some would call him a treasure hunter, and it's true that he'd made his hobby pay now and then, in a moderate way, when he succeeded in finding things that had been forgotten, things that others had missed. But nothing, nothing he had ever stumbled upon had prepared him for what he was about to discover. He was just shoving a thick old volume of 17th century ship's logs back onto the shelf when he thought he saw something mashed behind it, way at the back behind the books, away from the light. He squinted, reached back into the gap, and felt with his hand. He cringed a bit at the cold, tearing feel of cobwebs. Got a nasty spider bite for his trouble. But there was something back there. Carefully, he pulled it out. This very bundle that you're holding in your hands right now. He pulled it out and carried it over to the table beside the window. The day outside was old and tired, hunched under low gray clouds with little light to lend to the dark paneled room. Someone in a recent decade had attacked the high-beamed ceiling with fluorescent tube fixtures, but their sickly, buzzing light seemed to flicker into the dark walls and be absorbed. So he switched on the little portable reading light he'd brought with him and sat down to pore over these pages. English. Late 16th century. A working draft, not a fair copy. There aren't many people alive able to read these faded old lines, much less appreciate their importance. They're written in a forgotten English shorthand, centuries out of use. But our man had studied similar texts before. And as he slowly deciphered these faded pages, he leaned over more and more closely until the musty scent of them filled his nose, and he stood up quickly and took a few long steps over to the hall door. He'd closed it when he came into the room, he was sure. But now it was wide open, and he'd glimpsed the outline of a figure standing in it, peering into the room at him. This, of all moments, he wanted a little privacy. He needed it. He reached the door and stepped out into the hall. Looked in both directions. Well, someone was playing tricks. The long hallway was empty in either direction. No way anyone could have covered the length of it in the time it had taken him to cross the room. So they must have ducked into one of the other doorways that led off the hall. Well, he wasn't going to waste time playing hide-and-seek. He listened, but any stealthy sound of movement was drowned out by the sounds from the floor below. The basement, it must be, because he was on the main floor. A loud, muffled voice, or was it voices, raised in anger or argument. Sound strangely out of place here in this remote old pile of a house that felt so quiet and forgotten. He listened for a few seconds, but the voices were too muffled for him to make out any words. So he shut the hall door firmly. It must just be that old museum docent who had let him into the place. Yelling over the telephone, maybe. He looked out the window and could see that their two cars were the only ones in the parking lot. The voices went on, but faded from his awareness as he dove back into this little stack of papers here. And felt his heartbeat quicken. If this was what it seemed to be, if it wasn't a forgery, then he was holding a legend in his hands. Latitude, longitude, accurate maps. Of course, you know all these things are relatively new, painfully developed over the last 3 centuries at the cost of many a good sailor's life. Before that, back in the 16th century, say, everyone relied on things that the English called routiers, navigators' logs, written descriptions of journeys that recorded how many days a ship had sailed toward this or that constellation in a certain time of the year, and how the coastline had looked when they got there, and what rivers and towns there were along the coast. What he had found in that cloudy Dutch corner of the world, the thing that you're holding in your hands right now was part of an old, a very old, Routier. And it recorded no ordinary journey. As he read on, he began to suspect. Could it be true? Could he really be holding? Yes. Yes, this must be part of the long-lost sailing log of Francis Drake's treasure-hunting circumnavigation in the late 1570s. While the writer was sometimes intentionally vague, some of the details were coded, but all the other little specifics in the text began to line up. Well, like any treasure hunter worth his salt, our man knew all the contradicting lore of Drake's voyage from start to finish. And as he grew more and more certain, his hands began to tremble with excitement. And then, yes, incredible! The cramped text spoke of a long winter spent in foggy, frigid waters, and of an unwholesome, burdensome cargo buried ashore. Well, according to the legends, that must be the treasure that Drake had decided was haunted. There were drawings on the pages, faint sketches of jagged headlands nearest where the cargo had been buried. And he began to wonder how quickly he could arrange things, how soon he could catch a plane to the other side of the world, to that desolate northwest coast of America. A sound tore his attention away from his scheming and from the jottings of 400 years ago. The sound of the shouting on the floor below coming to a heated climax. It was incredible to hear such passions vented in that dead old place. The contradiction made the sounds even more unsettling than they would have been. Still impossible to be sure how many people were involved. At one moment it seemed like many voices, and then the next, just one person railing in monologue. He tried to block it out, tried to focus on this incredible document in his hand, but suddenly there fell a silence so complete that it riveted his attention. It lasted only 3, maybe 4 seconds. Just long enough for him to wonder if whatever had happened was over. And then came a piercing scream, strangling down into nothing. For a moment he was frozen in shock and horror. And then in one motion he swept all his things from the tabletop and crammed them into his bag. These papers, this antique Routier that he'd found, it went into the bag, too, without him even thinking about it. He was going to leave. Now. The thought of going out the window even crossed his mind. But that was ridiculous. He didn't know for certain what had happened. He'd go out the door. Yes, he'd right out the door, right now. And he'd call the police as he went. He crossed the room swiftly, pawing through his bag. His phone was in there, of course. It must be. He'd find it at any moment. Any moment now. He stopped his search for the phone just long enough to open the door to the hall, and as soon as he touched the knob, he could feel someone turning it from the outside. Experience slammed on the brakes, and everything in the world slowed to a crawl. He could feel every millimeter of the doorknob slipping through his hand, so slowly that he could think 1,000 nightmares as it turned, but just too quickly for his body to grip and resist. And then he watched the door opening toward him, so slowly that he noticed the swirling patterns of the faded wallpaper across the hall, but a step too fast for his body to react and block. There was someone out there, a figure, tall, lean, hostile, moving toward him in motion so slow that the only things slower were all of his reactions. His eyes widened as he stumbled back, dropped his bag, and gave an involuntary cry. And then time sprang back into its usual gear, faster even, and a skinny old museum caretaker was advancing on him, hissing like a goose, snapping out whispered indignities in Dutch too fast to follow.
Really too much, sir. What could be the meaning of it? Wake the devil, this last outburst. That scream...
Something could be broken. Madness. Our man picked up his bag and hastened to explain, in the best of his own slow, bookish Dutch, that there had been some mistake. He'd been disturbed as well. The sounds were coming from the floor below, from the basement. This explanation did nothing to placate the docent, who responded with an incensed stream of rebuke, too hot and fast for our man to catch much of. The main thrust of the invective seemed to be that the docent could never believe that. It was patently false, impossible. The building had no basement. Well, there was nothing for our man to do but gather his fallen bag and edge away through the door into the hall, then out of the building, apologizing, denying knowledge, admitting ignorance, apologizing, and getting away from there. And once away, and a night spent at his hotel, poring again and again over the incredible piece of history that had found its way into his bag. He says that 72 hours hadn't passed before he was on a flight to Seattle-Tacoma International, the airport nearest to the coast that he couldn't wait to reach. What he found there would be far, far beyond his wildest imaginings, and not at all what he expected. Will he be rich? Will he survive? We'll begin to find out on the next episode. We're experimenting with this format of breaking these longer stories up into episodes that are shorter and punchier than the full-length ones we do on the Camp Monsters podcast. If you like it, leave a good review. If you don't, oh, come on, don't leave a comment like that. Just send an email to buriedlegendspodcast@gmail.com. We'll get the message. That's also a great place to send any legends that you might want to hear us try to unearth. As many ideas as we have, we're always looking for more. Always looking for more. More and more and more. Why? Nick Patriot wishes he knew. Isn't it enough being the greatest sound engineer the podcastverse has ever known? It would be, if Nick could conceive the meaning of that word, enough. But the relentless drive that's carried him to these heights now threatens to drive him over the edge. Nah, I'm just kidding. You're doing okie dokie, right, Nick? Right? Nick? Chelsea Davis is our senior producer, and she's both okie dokie and A-OK. Gee whiz. As always, these stories are written and told by yours truly, Weston Davis. And a friendly reminder that the legends we unearth here are just legends. Well, folks may claim to have had similar experiences, but it's up to you to decide what's real and what's just a tall tale. Thanks for listening. Subscribe if you haven't already. Leave a nice review, tell your friends, and join us again for the next episode, coming soon.